Welcome to the Squawker Talker podcast. I'm your host, Greg Johnson, and joining me today for a pre-season special, we're going to talk about transfers and all the preparation that clubs are doing ahead of the new season, is Greg Stobart. How are you doing, Greg?
I'm very good, thank you, Greg.
Very good, very good. And also, Mohamed Butt, how are you, man?
Pretty good. The heat is on.
The heat is on. In some ways, the heat is also on for the Premier League's top six. Pre-season is upon us. Teams have been playing. The big results this week have been United and Liverpool both beating Wigan 2-0, basically in the space of 2 days, Saturday and Sunday, and Chelsea losing 2-0 to Rapid Vienna in their first game of pre-season. How much can we read into these kind of first results of pre-season? Is it just friendlies? Are there conclusions you can draw, Greg?
Not particularly, Greg. If you think back to Van Gaal's first pre-season when United did pretty well and then look what happened as soon as the season started, they lost to Swansea that year. You can never learn a lot. A manager can learn a lot, coaching, and it's all about the fitness, the training ground, the tactical philosophies, the games, genuinely, and more, I know you've got the International Champions Cup and all this kind of stuff, and they try and make it serious, but it's all about fitness, building something, and the coaches don't really care about the results, to be honest.
Mo, one of the players that stood out in the Man United match in particular was Henrik Mkhitaryan. And just going back to Stobes' point on, you know, pre-season's gone by, especially the Van Gaal one when Ander Herrera joined the club. I remember there was a game where United absolutely spanked. I think it was even MLS All-Star team or LA Galaxy, I'm not quite sure which, but Herrera got like five assists. It was just through ball after through ball each time. Yeah. Is there a worry that maybe, you know, after showing a bit of glamour against Wigan, maybe we're going to overrate Mkhitaryan, or is he the real deal?
I think both are true. I think there's definitely a risk of thinking, oh my God, he's amazing, because he, you know, he has to deal with the physicality of the Premier League, and it does, that does hit like a ton of bricks. You know, Memphis still, a year on, hasn't really got to grips with it. So we need to, you know, he's done well against Wigan, but let's not, he might do it against it right away from the Premier League, but you need to be ready to say that, okay, he might need a couple of months to adapt to the literal physical style of the Premier League, but he is class. He's pure class.
I think the benefit for Mkhitaryan and a few of the others is, in a tournament year, it's always so messy pre-season. Yeah. He's got a full pre-season under Mourinho to get on the table, to settle in on and off the pitch, and that will really help, because you look at some clubs, you know, Arsenal, some of their guys aren't going to be coming back until a week before the start of the season. It's always really difficult, but if you can get a full pre-season out in like Mkhitaryan, it's really going to help.
Yeah.
And obviously, it's hard to really know what's going to happen with Mourinho's Man United, because a lot of, as you say, a lot of the players that were in the tournaments this summer, they're not actually in the squads. Chris Smalling hasn't arrived, so Bailly and Blind have looked good together on Saturday, but will they be the pair when he comes back? Zlatan hasn't come back into the team yet. Rooney's still out. Marcus Rashford. Mo, what do you think is going to be the kind of, how are they going to come into this team?
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? It was nice watching United play with a sense of intent against, you know, and had to try and score a goal. It was very nice. First time shots as well. You know, all that stuff was fantastic. The shots weren't necessarily good, mind you, but, you know, but it's so hard to judge that team purely because the entire shape of the side didn't work, because James Wilson is a fast forward. He played up front, very quick, very nippy, gets on the shoulder, but he's not strong at all. He's about 5 stone soaking through. You know, he's just out-muscled too easily. Put Zlatan up there, changes the entire dynamic of the side. So it's really, I mean, Stokes is right. It's just so hard to judge.
And they have got beat by the same scoreline again by Liverpool. Gary Caldwell put out a different team because in his press conference after the game, he did say that, you know, this is more an experience thing. They weren't really expecting everything in these games. And I think they're actually quite happy they contained the scoreline to just 2-0. I mean, I was at the Man United game, and I'll be honest with you, United didn't really have to put that much effort in to actually get the scoreline they did in the end. But I mean, one team that didn't get over their first hurdle was Chelsea. They lost 2-0 in Vienna to Rapid Vienna. Mo, I know you watched the game. What were the main things you took from Antonio Conte's debut?
I mean, they need to sign centre-halves, plural. John Terry will get better as he gets more fitness, because he's like 60 years old. But he's still, you know, the first goal Rapid Vienna scored, it looked like Barcelona. And Chelsea had absorbed Conte's tactics very well already.
So are you saying that Chelsea made them look like Barcelona, or they actually are?
No, they made them look like Barcelona.
I was going to say.
It was, Chelsea, they'd already absorbed the tactics that Conte had taught. They were very compact, very like Italy. It's compressed space between the lines, compressed the pitch horizontally, so they were constantly moving to one side of the pitch. But yet, when Rafa Viana got the ball between their midfield and defence, John Terry and Papi Gilabogi had no idea what to do. And that's a real problem. They need more defensive leaders.
I think even with those players, it might improve, given Conte started on Wednesday and the game was Saturday. So he didn't exactly have a long time. I know he's one of the managers who's doing double training sessions, but didn't have a lot of time. That might improve, but certainly agree with Mo on the centre-back thing. I mean, we're already in a situation where Kurt Zouma is Chelsea's most important centre-back, and he's injured and very young as well. Mm. And they 20, really need to 20,
21 years old, I think. Yeah. It's a really weird situation, because the thing is, none of their defenders you could really say you rely on. Gary Cahill, John Terry, Papa Gila Boji. Matt Miazga is complete unknown. He might actually be really good, but, you know, it's nothing proven. They desperately need, I think, two centre-halves, one to start next to Zouma and one to be their primary backup. Because as much as the rest of their side actually will get better, as Stope says, you can see how they'll get better with more time learning Conte's system. And when you get Eden Hazard back, once you get an actual striker next to Diego Costa, it changes everything. But centre-halves, I think, is a problem they need to address.
Did he play 4-4-2?
No, it was 4-4-1-1. Ruben Loftus-Cheek played off Diego Costa, but he was very high. It was clearly, they were clear separate lines. But
yeah, Ruben Loftus-Cheek playing an attacking role. I mean, it's something you touched on in a previous pod where Mourinho put him in, was like a number 10 position, and then kind of dismissed him for not quite being good enough. Is that something you think Conte was just experimenting with, or do you reckon he could see that might be his role?
I think every other striker wasn't there. I think it's that probably is what was going on there. He just had no other players. I mean, he could play there. He's a talented footballer, but I would imagine that Conte has a preference for two strikers, and I think that's what we'll see again. Michy Batshuayi, they paid an awful lot of money for him. And Diego Costa, they paid a lot of money for him 2 years ago. I think they'll unite the two up front.
Yeah, the plan is, actually, people at Chelsea saying the plan is a 4-4-2 or variations thereof. So I think it's more getting players to play the system rather than fitting the system around players.
Yeah, I think you said 4-4-2, and I agree. That's obviously the plan. But I have a feeling they might have to at some point adapt to 3-5-2, because I can't see 4-4-2 really having the necessary coverage in midfield. Once you put Cesc Fabregas in there, if you have Kante and Matic in there, that's a lot of legs, and that's going to cover a lot of ground. But if you put Cesc in there with either of those guys, I think suddenly you become a little bit lightweight, and you know, maybe you want to put Cesc in at midfield three, but then to do a midfield three with a front two, need three at the back.
But it all comes back
to needing centre backs.
But yeah, I was going to say, you need some very good centre backs to play the 3-5-2 our Conte likes it. And I don't think Chelsea, as we just said.
This is what I'm saying. They need to buy centre backs. This is what I'm saying.
If you look at Cesc and Kante, it's not too dissimilar to Drinkwater and Kante last season. I think they're already putting an awful lot of stock in what Kante is going to do with his legs, his energy, his reading of the game.
Absolutely. Be interested to see how it all turns out, as with all these teams going for pre-season. We might be seeing an evolution in the weeks to come. But just as a general point, Stobes, we saw Jurgen Klopp come into the Premier League at Liverpool midway through the season last year. And the change in Liverpool's style of play and their intensity, and they just looked like they had more of an idea what they were doing very quickly. And people were quite surprised at how sudden the effect of Klopp as a manager was coming in. You were saying there earlier, like, Conte's just been in the job for, what, a week or so? And he's already, clearly, you know, his ideas are being learned. Is the kind of tactical side of pre-season bigger than ever in football?
Yeah, it's massive. I mean, it's so important for a start, let's be honest. And, you know, back in the day, maybe coaches in England didn't quite realise that, but now you've got...
It was all dune runs and fitness training and cross-country,
exactly,
wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the days of running through the woods are long gone. I mean, a lot of teams are doing double training sessions, you know, Tottenham, Chelsea. I'm not sure that's particularly a sensible way to go. You know, our friend Raymond Verhagen will tell us that. You know, I actually think Wenger's actually playing it quite well by giving the likes of Alexis Sanchez, Laurent Koscielny a lot of rest over the summer, because it's been a long year for a lot of these players. But yeah, a lot of it's the tactical drilling, the nuances, combined with the fitness, which is why Conte's doing the double sessions. He's doing the tactical work in the morning, and then they're doing fitness in the afternoon.
That's the essential part. The main part of pre-season is preparing your team. That's why Louis van Gaal made such a fuss about the tours at Man United. He wanted time to prepare his team, which means time on the training pitch with them to teach them his thing. Now, of course, as it turns out, Louis van Gaal maybe could have used a little bit less time with his players, and they might have actually favoured some freedom. But, you know, essentially, you need time on the field. You need time on the training field to really impart your ideas, and so that's key.
We're just looking at the fixture list for the big teams. It's quite noticeable that City are playing far less games than anybody else. I think it's four or five that they're doing compared to a lot of other teams. Is that a sign that Pep is taking the training aspect, the training opportunity of pre-season, much more serious than other people? I mean, obviously, he's seen as this very like conceptual coach that created these big systems that did lots of amazing things at Bayern and Barcelona. Is he going to need that time to really hit the ground running with City, then?
I mean, absolutely. Man City are a squad as currently composed. They took an entire season to learn 3-5-2 and then didn't learn 3-5-2 from Roberto Mancini. They need time to be taught things. Pep has a lot of concepts that are actually simple once you learn them, but until you learn them, they can seem complex, and he needs time on the training field. It's no surprise to me that he's minimized the amount of traveling, the amount of game time. He wants more and more, as much time on the training pitch as possible to teach these players that these concepts, the key concepts, and to work on shape and to work on fundamentals of play.
Stopes, I know you've been up in Manchester recently, you know, do what you do as a reporter, trying to find some stories. And what have you heard about coming from the City camp in terms of their preparations and what they're kind of really focusing on this summer to get right for the season ahead?
I think, a lot of the message from City has actually been business as usual. They don't want to change too much. Mm. You know, he's not come in and got rid of all the medical staff or made sweeping changes. And he's not actually dismantled the squad quite as much as some of us might have expected. Mm. I think they're actually aiming for this continuity. I think one thing we will see is he will certainly, some of the academy kids will travel with the squad and they'll be training daily with the squad, because A, it's a massive part of City's plan to bring through the academy kids, and also Pep wants them involved. He wants Aguero playing with the next big thing coming through from the academy. So that's the big thing for them, I think.
And how do you think that, as Mo brought up before, how do you think that compares to Van Gaal? And also Mourinho, in summers gone by, there's been a bit of a tension between like the commercial activities of the club wanting to go on tour to all these places and spread the brand, and the actual opportunity to do the actual work on the training field to get the team prepared.
Well, I think most managers say they understand you've got to strike a balance. I mean, one of the problems with Van Gaal was he thought he knew better than everyone else. So he was trying to tell the club secretary where they've got to stay, where they've got to train. And it ended up making the journeys worse. That's why, you know, I think it was David Moyes who had them out stretching on the beach one season, didn't he? But, you know, obviously you've got to find the balance, and United are probably the worst. They see the opportunity and they milk it. And, you know, we know they're going, I think they've already gone off to China now. Looking back, it benefits clubs when they don't have to do that. I mean, for years and years, Arsenal resisted going to the Far East or going to America because Wenger used to, I think he used to go to Austria. They used to do a pre-season camp then and get ready for the season. And eventually Wenger had to give in to the commercial demands. But you look back at Chelsea 2 years ago, the 1 year they got their transfer business done early when they signed Diego Costa, Cesc Fabregas, and they didn't go trekking around the world. They went to Austria and they absolutely ran away with the league, and it was done by Christmas.
Well, same with Leicester as well. Last season, I don't think they were the only team that didn't go abroad to do their pre-season.
Yeah.
And look what happened. I mean, clearly there were more things at play in that season than pre-season.
It's a huge thing not travelling that much. I remember Guardiola's first season at Bayern, they didn't go on tour. They were playing games in the middle of the summer, like against these really weird lower league German sides, and they were beating them like 6-7-1 or whatever.
I do think there is a tradition at Bayern to do that, though. I think it's something they've done it this year as well with Ancelotti.
That just shows how organisationally brilliant Bayern are, because that's absolutely the best way to do pre-season is training, gaming against lower sides, because the games, as Stobe said, they're about fitness and they're not necessarily about like the result or anything like that. So just minutes on the pitch, getting your legs, getting your muscles right. And just training.
We've seen, obviously, Pochettino is a manager that really believes in kind of hammering home the fitness aspect with his double, sometimes triple sessions on the training field. But there was a sense that Tottenham kind of slowed up at the end of last season. Do you think there's any concern that he's often talked about as a child of Marcello Bielsa and his style of thing. And one of the Bielsa's traits as a club manager is his teams do seem to peter out towards the end of the season because the intensity he demands of them both in pre-season and in the season. Do you reckon, is there any concern in Tottenham about how things are done, whether they can improve on what happened last year, make sure there isn't that kind of loss of energy in the last few months?
I think the two things you'd say about Tottenham are, one, Pochettino's not going to change his methods. He's going to hammer home the fitness. He's going to do the double training sessions. He wants them to be the fittest, hardest running team in the league, as they were for most of last season.
And didn't do them too bad, really, did it?
And also their injury record wasn't bad. So Tottenham are one of the best for the sport science. I mean, you look at the problem with Arsenal and Man United isn't necessarily that the players are tired, but their sports science has let them down quite a lot. Tottenham are good for that. But you have to look at Pochettino's record. It's not, like you said, it's not just Tottenham, it's at Southampton too.
Espanyol's right. There was a similar kind of, you know, falling off basically towards the end with Espanyol as well.
And for Tottenham, the big worry will be if there's mental fatigue. You've got five players who were involved in that disastrous England Euro 2016 campaign. They're going to come back. He's going to start hammering them straight away. Are they going to be mentally fresh? You know, some of them might have to go out to Australia this week. It's a long way. And if they're not mentally sharp, you don't hit the ground running.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's on the Australia point. This just reminded me when United went to the I think the World Club Cup after winning the treble. They actually credited their break in the middle of the season where they didn't play the FA Cup and they went to Australia and did this nice little tournament. Mm-hmm. They actually said that refreshed them to come back and win the title. So maybe there is a lovely thing in down under in Australia. There might be a kind of, you know, party atmosphere for Kane to kind of re-find his vigour and come back refreshed. Maybe that's wishful thinking as an England fan, perhaps. But Mo, who are the clubs that you think have got the most to kind of prove? We talked about the managers. Which are the clubs that you think there's been a lot of transfers coming in and the sides that really need to kind of use this summer to really galvanise themselves and come together?
Oh, Manchester City and United are without a doubt the teams with the most to prove. Chelsea had a terrible season. It's mostly the result of Jose Mourinho's massive ego. So I think Spurs and Arsenal are trending upwards. They'll keep doing so. I mean, Arsenal need to buy a striker, but whatever. No, United and City absolutely have... City have repeatedly stalled, and that their project that they started way back when is now coming to an end with Yaya Toure surely going to depart. David Silva's getting older. Sergio Aguero is just plateaued as this sort of good but not great forward, or great but not elite, whatever you want to...
City fans might not like that one.
Well, okay, great but not elite. You know, you wouldn't have them in the top three strikers in the world, would you? Let's be honest. They need to prove, they need to change, and obviously now they've finally got their guy. They've been shaping their club for years, building it to Pep Guardiola. This is like the New York Knicks in 2010 with LeBron James. They actually got LeBron James. Well, they've gotten Pep Guardiola. Now they need to prove that it was worth it. They need to get the players in, need to get the systems established. And I mean, United is just, we've talked about this at length, you know, that they were awful. They've been awful for 3 years. They've got all this money. They've spent all this money. They've got the big man now. He's got Zlatan and Jose. They've got two big men. They just got to make it happen.
So we've talked a lot about like kind of institutional weaknesses of United over the past few months, lack of directors of football, lack of those structures that other clubs like Bayern, you know, use to great effect. Is there a sense, I mean, United are almost like the last great dictatorship in Europe or something, where they've lost Fergie and there's been like a hole in the club where they've needed this big personality to give kind of purpose and direction to every other element? I mean, look at this summer. Jose's in. He's clearly got an idea what he wants to do. The transfer business has been absolutely on point. Very quick, very effective, very efficient as well. I mean, on Saturday, okay, it's the first game of preseason and all that, but team looked pretty, you know, they won in second gear because they could. And they looked like they already understand his methods and what he wanted to do. There's a clear difference in some parts of teams, or even Van Gaal's football as well. Is there a sense that, you know, even if the systems and the institutional things in United might not be on point, you know, Mourinho, he is so far proven to be that guy. Like, he really does look like a United manager.
Yeah, you're right. It's almost like Mourinho's the most obvious, maybe one of the last of the old school managers left in terms of managing almost every aspect of the game, of the club, from the academy to the first team to the transfers.
And he's hungry for it as well, isn't he?
Yeah, he obviously wants to do it. I mean, when he's worked with technical directors, he's fallen out with them. You know, he left Chelsea. The rot started with Marco Lemonalo because he didn't get the players he wanted. Yep. Last summer, and now he's got that control, and he's also got an agent who's very close with the powers that be at United, and it kind of suits him. Personally, I think in modern football, it's too much for one person to take on that much, or you need to delegate exceptionally well to your recruitment guys, for example, especially over transfers. But Mourinho's always known what he wants. He's got the strength of personality, and I think if you're looking for a like for Ferguson in that sense, he's certainly as close as you can get.
Yeah, I mean, that's why he was always the choice, really. I mean, whatever United fans felt about his football and about his attitude and the way he conducted himself with a big club in Spain and with Real Madrid, you know, he learned from Sir Bobby Robson. You know, so he's got that old school mentality in him. You know, and so he was the only one, because Fergie, United organizationally terrible, as Greg said. There's no organization there. It was just Fergie was a genius and it worked. So then you're gonna get rid of a genius. You need to replace him with a genius. Otherwise, your club's gonna... Well, I mean, it's gonna do what United did for 3 years.
Yeah, it's interesting set with Bobby Robson, because I wasn't quite there. I'm not quite old enough to be there when that all happened. But it was said that at the time they brought him in both at PSV and at Barcelona because they had a sense that the dressing room needed an old school British manager to kind of be, you know, kind of tell them where it was at and shout the odds. So
Robbie Robson came after Cruyff. So I mean, that, you can see what they were thinking there. They fell out with the Barcelona hierarchy, fell out with Cruyff.
Yeah,
and so they wanted someone who's like almost the polar opposite.
Yeah,
they
wanted a disciplinarian, authoritarian. Basically,
yeah, but who would also get the players to love him? You know, in that sort of way that Bobby Robson was just excellent at doing.
Mm. And I guess Mourinho is looking at some of the reactions to his players over the years. But moving on now, we've looked at the kind of pre-season plans for a lot of the clubs. Now let's move on to how pre-season might be shaping the transfer window as well. And we've already seen some big deals happen. Kante to Chelsea, as we were talking earlier, that 4-4-2, he's the player that's going to make it work if it is going to work. But Stokes, you've broke a story about he potentially wanted to go to Arsenal, but things didn't quite work out there on that deal.
Yeah, I mean, for a start, it just shows you what happens in a transfer window. We've seen Arsenal sign Xhaka already. They wanted Kante. They thought the release clause was 20 million, but actually a condition of it was meant that it had to be negotiated with another club. It's more quite complicated.
Right.
But Chelsea originally wanted Raja Nainggolan. No secret of that. Didn't get him. They've actually got a superior player in Kante, I've got to say. And certainly, if you're looking at Premier League experience, someone who's proven it here. But yeah, I mean, Kante going into the Euros, he thought he was going to sign for Arsenal. You saw Wenger's been gushing about him. Arsenal said they were going to make a bid and they never did. They never made a formal offer. It opened the door for Chelsea and Kante saw the opportunity to work with Conte, which was very exciting. Chelsea offered him a lot of money. He's on £100,000 a week and they were willing to pay the transfer fee and got it done in a week.
Absolutely baffling that Arsenal didn't move for him. I know they got Granit Xhaka and Granit Xhaka's amazing, but you could pair Granit Xhaka and N'Golo Kante. That's actually a really, really good midfield too. I have no idea. Well, I mean, you can tell what Arsenal were thinking. No, I'm not paying that.
Yeah, Wenger didn't want to spend that money. He thought if it's £20 million on the dot and £60,000 a week, we'll do him, we'll add him. But then it got to the stage where the money went up. He started questioning himself and then he looked at his squad and he said, I've got Granit Xhaka, but I've also got Aaron Ramsey, Jack Wilshere,
Santi
Cazorla,
well.
Francis Coquelin. How can I justify fitting Kante in?
So. He's holding them back at this point, isn't he, really, Wenger? It's just sign N'Golo Kante. He's amazing. And then you have N'Golo Kante and Granit Xhaka. And then you've got Elneny as a backup and Coquelin as a backup.
I think Arsenal fans are already ready to explode. I mean, we saw it last year when they only signed Petr Cech and Wenger said there's no one else out there and then they just bombed the season and they're rubbish. And I think we're already starting to see it with some of the Arsenal fans. They signed Xhaka nice and early. It's a really good piece of business. But if they go another summer without signing a striker, there's going to be riots outside the Emirates.
Well, it's that dynamic presence. I mean, last season, Arsenal fans were absolutely mystified as to how Schneiderlin went to United because he was another player heavily linked to Arsenal. He seemed to fit the bill of what they needed, what they were looking for. Wenger's got a slightly more sluggish. I mean, Jack is a very good player, but he's more of a kind of static holding midfielder than someone that's going to add a bit of drive.
You could pair them together. That's the thing. I think, and in fact, in an ideal world, you would pair them together.
But then they do have Elneny, who is a very good box.
Elneny's another one.
I like Elneny. Elneny's a really good player, but I mean, Elneny, I would say, is really ideally suited into more of a role, more of the same sort of role that Xhaka does. Whereas Kante is something completely different because he gives you he can play box to box in most games, but then if you need someone to just sit there and hold in a bigger European away game, he can do that as well. And Arsenal have no one like that. They've just got Coquelin who runs around and tackles people, which, okay, it's fine if you're playing Hull, but as soon as you're playing Barcelona, you're just going to get ripped to pieces.
In Wenger's defence, what he says is, I only want top quality and there's not a lot out there. He's done well with signing, let's be honest. He managed to get Ozil in, Alexis was good business, Petr Cech was good business. I think Granit Xhaka will end up being good business, but the problem is he's still too careful. He's still too scared of making a mistake and everyone saying, Wenger, why did you spend £20 million or £30 million on this player and it went wrong? And he treats the club's money like it's his own. And Arsenal are absolutely loaded. I think they've got £190 million in cash reserves in the bank, so they can afford to spend it.
Well, speaking of top talent and a top budget like that, Paul Pogba to United. It's still dragging on, and it's still probably the biggest story of the transfer window at the moment. But apparently Real Madrid have come in and asked for more time to get their money together. Where do you think this is at? I mean, you've said in the past that Pogba potentially prefers a move to Real Madrid, but United probably have the cash here and now to actually pay for him. So where do you still think we'll probably see Real Madrid coming in late for him, or United now the front runners?
I think he's going to sign for United, and United seem pretty confident. You're right, certainly Real Madrid, if they want to get in the way, they will. I don't think it's a secret now that Pogba would prefer to go to Real Madrid. United are well down the line. They've already agreed a transfer fee. They've started talking to Juventus. They haven't made an official bid yet. And basically, it's up to Pogba to make his mind up. And as soon as he gives his thumbs up, which he hadn't as of Friday, as soon as he gives the thumbs up, United will rush it through as soon as possible. We've heard Jose Mourinho saying he's not going to wait until the end of August. He wants it done now. He's got another couple of weeks of holiday, so no rush in that sense. But United want it done in the next couple of weeks, and I think they will probably do it.
It's another weird thing of like summer transfer windows and the pre-season. In the past, I guess, agreeing something with the player and then going to the club, that would almost be what people would say was tapping up or something like that. How have things changed on that front? Is it just a bit more of a fluid situation when negotiations happen in the modern game?
Nothing's changed. It's always gone on. I don't think I've ever heard of a deal where the player hasn't been sounded out first, whether their salary demands, whether they'd be interested. Every single transfer, the player's sounded out before there's contact made with the club. It's just now it's a little bit more open. You can do it pretty brazenly with that and get away with it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember back in the day,
Peter Kenyon.
Peter Kenyon was scandalous at the time. And people insiders were saying, like, happens all the time. And we all thought, no, can't happen all the time. That's not how it happens on Football Manager. You know, you have to agree a fee first, but no, that's exactly.
But it's weird how it was a massive, massive topic for years, and people were threatening to sue over clubs and stuff like that. It never got resolved. It just seems to have dropped off the news agenda that these things happen now.
Yeah, you're right. You remember when Man United signed Berbatov and like United basically kidnapped him because he was supposed to be talking to Man City and United took him away without permission. But yeah, it happened all along. I think they're a bit more intelligent about it now. They've got the internet and they've got everything on their phones. And the player doesn't necessarily have to be present. Like when you look back on Ashley Cole or Rio Ferdinand meeting people, they shouldn't have. The player's not necessarily there all the time. You know, with United and Pogba, it's been Mino Raiola acting on Pogba's behalf. He's already talking to United about Mkhitaryan and Ibrahimovic anyway. So how can you stop him talking about Pogba if they're in the same room?
I'm here. I may as well. Hey, another guy, Paul Pogba, you fancy? Yeah. He's not too bad.
But how does summer holidays get in the way of summer transfers then? Or because of that kind of situation, does it not really matter? They just it carries on regardless.
It doesn't matter. Everyone's got a mobile phone. If Pogba needs to do something quickly, I'm sure he'll cut his holiday short and he'll come over. If not, he'll do it. He'll do it after, but I don't think it makes much difference.
Yeah, no, a bit on the Real Madrid thing. I have a feeling what's holding the thing up is Real Madrid's style has usually been to buy first, then sell later. Like at one point in 2009, they had Cristiano Ronaldo, Kaká, Robben and Schneider on their squad. And because what they did was they bought those first two and then they sold the latter two who were already there. They sell late, they buy early, sell late. And I think what's complicating this is they need to sell first before they can buy. So they have to sell James Rodriguez or Isco or Toni Kroos or two of those three and to fund Pogba. And they that's not how they get down. So now they're having a bit of a, I don't know, maybe they're having a bit
of... It's almost like the power shift in Europe's kind of shifted a little bit as well. Because, I mean, Real Madrid used to be kind of taken for granted that they could kind of blow anyone out of the water. If they wanted someone, they'd get in. Whereas United are finally flexing their muscles as one of the richest clubs in the world. Partly because they have to kind of get back to the level they used to be at where they could kind of spend a little bit less and just continue it on. So, I mean, do you think this summer could be, you know, the first of many where United start to replace Real Madrid? And maybe the Premier League clubs with the TV money start to replace the top two in Spain for just blowing other clubs out of the water?
Well, I think in future Deloitte annual money reports that United are going to be top, especially if they're in the Champions League with the Premier League money, with the might of their commercial deals. I think one of the issues with Pogba and Real Madrid is, yeah, you're right, United have more money. They can afford to spend more. They want to spend £100 million plus on a player, whereas for Real Madrid, breaking the transfer window record again might annoy Bale and Ronaldo. £300,000 a week, I don't know what that is in euros, but that wouldn't put him far off Ronaldo, and I think it'd be a little bit more than what Bale's on at the moment. You've got dressing room issues there as well, whereas if he goes to United, you don't quite have those same issues because there's no superstar there already.
I mean, if they give him that, then they've got to give Ramos a new deal, Bale a new deal, Modric a new deal, Kroos a new deal, and then suddenly their wage bill is as big as Barcelona's. So yeah, you can see why they'll be more hesitant about money for once, which is obviously weird to say about Real Madrid, but I mean, you know, someone's obviously got their hands on the steering wheel over there.
Absolutely. Well, that's kind of, I guess, the glamorous side of a pre-season transfer business. One of the more practical ones, there's been another injury for Joe Gomez for Liverpool, which has set Liverpool's plans for defence back a little bit, and so there is talk now they're going to bring in someone to replace Joe Gomez in the short term. And the guy they've apparently picked is Ragnar Klavan, who plays for Augsburg in Germany. He's an older player, I think 30 years of age. So he's not someone they're going to be expecting to build the team around the long term. But what do you think of the idea of short-term signings like this? Does it ever work out well? Is it always become a bit of a compromise in the end, Stobes?
I think it helps if the manager knows the player and trusts them. Liverpool made a short-term signing in January when they got Stephen Coulker.
Mm.
And that's look how that worked out, you know. So personally, I don't see that. I think you should always be looking at the longer term option, and if there's not a longer term option, look to the academy. You know, Klopp's got a good record of bringing players through the academy. If this guy's good, great, but if he's not better than a kid who can come through and get the experience, I don't think Liverpool should be going that way. But we'll see. He might be all right. Hopefully Klopp knows what he's like, and I actually fancy Liverpool to have a decent season next year. No Europe I think would suit Klopp. But obviously, big issue, they've only got two fit centre-backs.
Yeah, it's a strange one, isn't it, this signing? But I think maybe he's just probably looking to get his own version of Kolo Touré, as in his own version of an experienced veteran who can come in and play like 15 games a season when everyone else is injured. I mean, they gave Mamadou Sakho the number 3 shirt today, so, and he's been cleared, obviously, of his drug ban that was...
Is that apparently absolute rubbish from the start there? UEFA just dropped the ball big time.
Completely screwed that up, so he's completely in the clear now. So when he comes back, you'd imagine he'll be raring to go. He'll be the leader of that defence once again, as he was. So, I mean, I think it can work as long as this guy can adapt to the Premier League at 30 years old. That's not necessarily going to be a given.
He's obviously happy with Lovren, Sakho, Matip as his main centre-backs.
Yeah, I mean, Matip, I'm going to be very interested to see how he does. He's had a knock as well, apparently, which has obviously added to the anxieties about fitness problems on Liverpool, especially given Klopp's record last season, which was very, very bad. But yeah, I mean, he's 6'4", I think. He's a big guy, you know, should help sort out their defensive set-piece problems, which were a big issue last year. But talking about players that are going to have to adapt to the Premier League, Stobes, you've got another line on Sofyan Boufal, who is apparently coming over to England. But we're not entirely sure which club. There's a few that are in for him at the moment.
Yeah, he's really highly rated. I mean, people at Lille comparing him to Eden Hazard. I don't think they don't say he's that level, but similar style of player. Mm. Loves to get on the ball and dribble. Watford have made a bid today, Monday. Everyone, €20 million they bid for him. I can't see it happening. Very ambitious from Watford, because every big club in Europe has been watching Boufal, which includes Arsenal, includes Chelsea. Tottenham and Southampton are very keen as well. Sevilla are also interested. So I think he'd prefer to go to the Premier League, but Sevilla, obviously, you know, Europa League winners, big club. Shows, I mean, a lot of people have been talking about how, you know, this almost new money for the second and third tier Premier League teams means they can compete for these kind of players. It's yet another example of a player who, a couple of years ago, would have been going to a top 4 or 5 club in the Premier League, potentially going to a mid-table club. But Watford have made their move. Very brave move, very ambitious. Can't blame them, but I don't think he'll go there.
They haven't really got a player like him either, Watford. They were quite a stodgy team last year. Not taking it away from them, but they played how they did, and they were actually quite good. But they didn't quite have that kind of ball-playing winger guy to really get at teams and get behind them. Could almost be, I mean, if he does well and he does go to Watford, could almost be their Payet, potentially, like a bit of inspiration.
Absolutely. I mean, he's really good. I don't think he'll go to Sevilla, because I think Sevilla have bought...
every single hipster player under the sun, aren't they?
They've bought six players so far in this transfer window, and 5 of them play attacking midfield. So it's clear what Sampaoli is planning to do with his team, and that's going to be, they're going to be fun to watch. But... I don't think. I think Premier League. He'll go to the Premier League. From what I've seen of him, he's really very good. Great vision, great movement on the ball. Like Greg says, I can't see him going to Watford. That's a bit of a reach. But wherever he does end up, it's going to be fascinating to see how he adapts to the Premier League, because Liga always produces some pretty good talent for the Premier League.
But then last season we saw Iturbe go to Bournemouth. He didn't really do anything, even. Christian Atsu is another young dribbler who hasn't really lit up the Premier League as people expected on loan from Chelsea. So it'll be interesting to see whether his kind of ability to get on the ball and get past people in France can translate to the English top flight.
Yeah, and part of that's choosing the right club. So if you go to Southampton, you've got a French-speaking manager who can help you on. Yeah. You go to Tottenham, you've got a tactical manager who coached other attacking midfielders like Lamela and Christian Eriksen, massively improving. I think he's the kind of player Tottenham need, really. They're going for this Nkudu, who's more of an out-and-out winger, but I think Tottenham really need someone who can get on the ball and take someone on and make something happen. I mean, one of the issues with Boufal is actually he had pretty serious knee injury. He underwent surgery in May, so he'd missed at least the first couple of months of the season, so that might be putting a few of the clubs off making a bid at this stage or until now. But I think for Tottenham or Southampton, be a great signing.
So if he has got this injury problem, do you think it's more of a case of buy this year, kind of expect more from him next season?
He'll get plenty of football and he'll be back in 3 or 4 months. So not ideal, of course, but you're looking at a long-term signing. If you're looking at a 22-year-old for 4 or 5 years, I think it makes a lot of sense still. And he's cheap, you know, in terms of the market. I mean, 20 million euros is quite a lot of money, but comparatively cheap for a player that highly rated.
And just as you mentioned there, Nkudu to Tottenham, is he going to be the replacement for Ng? Or what's the kind of plan behind that?
I think that's the plan. Tottenham have been pretty disappointed with Clinton Ng, both in the matches he's played and in training. Nkudu actually caught their eye when they were scouting Michy Batshuayi, who obviously they didn't get. He ended up going to Chelsea. But, you know, he's more of a dribbler. I think Ng, they saw as a player who'd look to get in behind onto through balls. And that's not really how Tottenham look to play, whereas I think Nkudu's more of a player. I haven't seen any of him really. He's more of a player who wants the ball to his feet and then he'll look to take people on. But supposedly a good player. From what I've heard, Bufal's actually stronger, but it'll be interesting to see what Tottenham do there. But it sounds like it's going to happen with Ng possibly going the other way on loan.
Well, just to wrap up the pod, we're going to have a look at the winners and losers of pre-season so far in terms of transfers, in terms of preparation. Okay, it's very early on, but if there are a couple of clubs that you think are doing things well or doing things poorly, or if not poorly, just have to improve, it'd be great to hear your thoughts. So, Mo, let's go first with yourself.
I think Barcelona and Bayern Munich have done excellently so far. Barcelona secured Samuel Umtiti and Lucas Digne for basically the same price as Arsenal paid for Granit Xhaka, which is ridiculous when you think of how good Umtiti looked at the Euros. And Denis Suarez too. Three players for the same price as Granit Xhaka. Yeah, so that's very well done, especially for a club like Barcelona who are usually pretty terrible in the transfer market. They overpay and they do deals late. And Bayern Munich, I mean, they haven't really made the one big move, but I mean, that's
Renato Sanchez. Kind of consolidating their position, isn't it?
Renato Sanchez is just stupendous. Oh, and of course, Juventus have played this window outrageously well so far, and now apparently they're going to lose Pogba, but Higuain now? I mean, they're just Bayern Munich-ing the Serie A, aren't they?
Well, Stokes, what about yourself?
The big one for me has got to be Man United, I think. Like we mentioned earlier, that Chelsea year when they managed to get Costa and Fabregas in early, Mourinho's clearly dictating the policies, getting the players he wants, got the mix between the youth of an Eric Bailly and the experience proven winning mentality and quality of Zlatan Ibrahimovic. I think Mkhitaryan potentially is a fantastic signing. I mean, I'd rather he didn't play off the right. You'd rather him in a central role rather than. I think Wayne Rooney's going to end up starting number 10, which might be a bit frustrating for United fans. But I think United are looking pretty good. And if they get Paul Pogba, I mean, they'll be going for the title and there's no chance of them finishing outside the top four next year.
And any clubs that you think should be doing better?
I would say Tottenham. As well as they've done scouting, they should have done some business by now. And of course, Arsenal, who have still not signed a striker.
Arsenal kind of becoming a given on these questions.
I'd say Tottenham, Arsenal and Leicester. Three teams in the Champions League next year. Arsenal signed one player and they're still screaming out for a striker. And if they do sign someone, it's probably going to be just to appease the fans. Leicester have lost their most important player last season.
And apparently Mahrez might be getting into feet as well.
Mahrez might leave too. They've kept Jamie Vardy, but without Mahrez and Kante, is that even going to work? And I agree, Tottenham, they've got a real opportunity now. You know, they're a big club. They're building this new stadium. They're in the Champions League. They've got an exciting manager. You know, as good as an Nkudu is, you know, or a Wanyama, it's not particularly inspiring for Tottenham. I think they could have pushed a bit harder to sign someone with a bit of X factor.
Then again, I mean, Tottenham have signed Janssen as well. I mean, Xhaka, who's a very good player, has gone to Arsenal. Are we falling into the cliche of banging on about North London clubs a little bit here? Or
no, I think Arsenal they've done okay, not done badly. Granit Xhaka's a great player, but I mean, they passed on Kante and they've yet to sign a starting centre forward. And of course, we haven't mentioned the fact that they've not signed a starting centre half. Mertesacker is yet another year older, yet another mile per hour slower. Gabriel, it still doesn't look like he's going to... Gabriel looks like the Brazilian Phil Jones at this point. And so it's just Laurent Koscielny versus the world. And I mean, you know, I like Laurent Koscielny as a defender. He's a good defender, but he's not that good. He's not Baresi and Maldini in one person playing, coached by Helena Herrera. So, you know, it's...
Arsenal. You could have just said Yap Stam is the shorthand.
Yeah, I could have said the big Dutch man. And of course, with Tottenham, I mean, it is really, I mean, Wanyama's a great signing and Vincent Janssen's a great signing. They just need that X factor. They needed it last season, frankly, And they definitely need it this season. They need someone with some stardust.
If Tottenham had Mahrez or Payet last season, someone to do that something out of nothing. I mean, they've got Harry Kane, who's brilliant in the box, but there's something out of nothing. The player who can drop a shoulder and go past people. I think Tottenham are just being so careful. Part of it, they've got the stadium to build. Partly, they've been burnt, you know, signed Soldado and Paulinho and these duds in recent years. And partly, they think they can find value in the market. Let's not forget, they spent less than £10 million on Eric Dier and Dele Alli combined. So they know what they're doing, but Mo's right. If they could have signed a big name, made a little bit more of a statement, that would have been favourable, but they still might.
So we have a few more weeks left to go for the rest of the pre-season leading up to August. I mean, I guess it's a case of watch this space for the teams that haven't quite done the business expected yet and, you know, watch out for the ones that have. So, thanks once again for joining us for Squawker Talker. I've been your host, Greg Johnson. I mean, as ever, squawker.com is right there on the internet for you to click on and read our latest analysis. Exclusive reports from Stobart, wonderful features by Mo, and many other features and reports and analysis and all the rest of it. You can find it all on the website anyway. We're on Twitter at Squawker as well. We're also on Facebook if you want to search for us and
we're
have
everywhere.
A click.
We are ubiquitous.
We are. We're getting everywhere. Snapchat and everything. Of course, subscribe to iTunes for more podcasts to come in pre-season and the season ahead. And that's my exhaustive plug-in done for the day. So, Greg, thanks for joining us.
Cheers, Greg. I'm going to open this door in a minute.
It's getting a bit hot. And thank you, Mo, as well.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening. See you soon.